extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here.
Welcome, everybody, to Extra Time, driven by Continental Tire from the AT&T Virtual 5G Studio. I am David Goss, alongside Matt Doyle and Kalen Carr. This is a flu game for Andrew Wiebe, although he is not performing. The family is sick. It seems like the whole house is in chaos right now in Kansas City, so we're just going to let him do his thing for the rest of today, and you guys are going to hang out with me. We're going to talk international soccer, MLS rumors, MLS transfers, Canadian national team with
this
a
is
huge
the Canada
moment.
Show. This is it's, the Canada show.
Should we do half French, half English?
We should try. Yeah, I bet that would go over real well.
Can Kalen, you want to start us in the French?
French is not a strong suit for me. Still working on it.
Yeah, but you know that, like, if Kylian Mbappe signs with the league, we're going to send you over to France to do a cool sit-down interview, and you got to be ready.
Dude, Thierry Henry signed with the league. I didn't get to go up there. So, I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure, but I'm ready to learn.
All right. Well, we are excited for this one. And then we have a huge mailbag because why not? One MLS game this weekend, so we'll talk about it. SKC versus Austin. And then, of course, MLS returns. I think it's a doubleheader on Friday night for a full weekend of games coming up. And we, of course, have our Thursday show to hit all of that with you. Let's get into the Prudus and Anders reminder of the day. And it is, I am a real man. This is not a Pinocchio moment. We got multiple tweets for our mailbag request today. One is Anders actually a real person or just some personality you guys created to blame stuff on and change topics? And Caleb Leone says, hi, Durs. I think he meant to write Anders. What is the best pizza shop in New York City? I'll hang up and listen. Is Anders a real person?
It's a tough question to answer. Sometimes it feels like he's not, but I think he is.
I think it would be too smart for us to invent this person who's a construct just to move
topics. Too smart. I would say too committed. Like, we maybe lack that follow through, but he is... Yeah. As Anders is typing in the chat right now, he's a caricature of a Sounders fan.
So we just have to do this for
he
the rest of time.
He could be a projection of Andrew Wiebe's mind. You know, it just could be what, like a I don't know, Fight Club-esque or maybe Mr. Robot, that type of thing. But just like a very intense Seattle-centric soccer version of that.
And you think that if Wiebe created a Tyler Durden?
Durden.
That it would be a Norwegian Sounders fan.
Yeah, telling us to like move on. Yeah, like telling us to move on to the next subject. He's doing it right now. Yeah, that's exactly what I think is happening. The only other thing is, like, I think at one point he wrote, I am a benevolent god. Anders is a benevolent god. So I think there's this version of it where it's maybe taking on its own life form. We got to be careful to not let him get too big. He does appear on Spaces. His voice has been heard on Spaces before.
I mean, you don't know that that's actually his voice. That could be Wiebe changing his voice.
Yeah, because in fairness, like Weeby's never on Spaces himself after he organizes it. So there's a good chance he's just logged in as the ETR account talking as Anders. That's why it never comes from Anders' account. Wow. We have connected all the dots. This is a special episode.
It's going to be a good show, guys. Here we go.
I'm looking forward to it. The cats are already involved because they can sniff this Anders conspiracy theory and they know what's up and what's going on. Let's start out with the great news. Canada World Cup qualifying. They are in a special two-leg series against Haiti to make it into the final round of CONCACAF World Cup qualifying. After their victory over Suriname last week, they go down to Port-au-Prince and they get a 1-0 win. The second game coming up Tuesday night, 9:05 p.m. Eastern time from SeatGeek Stadium in Bridgeview, Illinois, a place that Kalen Carr knows quite well. And I think you can vouch for the Canadianness in that building that just always exists, right?
Yes. Yeah. I'm trying to think. I was like trying to do, I was like, did we have a Canadian guy? I was looking for like a deep cut of a former Fire player from Canada that came through. I was like, I can't think of
you
that.
You played with what's his name in Houston?
Andre, you know?
Yeah. Redhead.
Oh, yeah.
He played for Canada for 45
and obviously,
years.
What's his name? Pat Onstad.
Yeah,
was Pat already gone by the time you got to the Dynamo?
He was gone. Yeah, Hainault was there, and I believe he scored a goal in the playoffs, maybe in 2012 play-in game in Bridgeview, and the crowd went nuts. I was very confused by it.
There we go. There's the connection. So, there it is. They've always been Canadian. Yeah. Let's go, Red. So they get the 1-0 win down in Haiti. Some interesting lineup changes. Marc-Anthony Kay, obviously, great LAFC player, gets into the starting lineup. And then Jonathan Osorio gets the assist to Kyle Larin, I think in the 12th minute, for the opening goal, Doyle. And they go on the road and get the win. This has been this right here, this exact game, has been the question for Canada, right? Can they get that tough result away in CONCACAF? Normally, it's to close out that qualifying round to get through. This was to set themselves up, and they finally got the job done.
They did, and it felt like it was a turning point, maybe, for Canada, not because of how they played, right? They actually... Well, I mean, there's a couple. You could say it's a turning point because of how they played, which is they didn't play well, but they still got the result. They still ended up pitching a shutout. They still got the road goal. They could have had two or three if Placide, the Haitian keeper, wasn't amazing, especially in those breakaway situations. Canada could have run away with this, and so you could look at it and be like, oh, I'm a little disappointed that it was only the 1-0, but it felt like, I mean, it's just such a sea change to see Canada go on the road in an important qualifier, not play well, and still get 3 points against a pretty good team. This Haiti team is pretty good. We saw it 2 years ago in the Gold Cup when they came back from 2-0 down and beat Canada. So this was not nothing. This was a big step. But as Canadian fans will tell you, it doesn't mean anything if they don't go back to the spiritual home of Canadian soccer, Bridgeview, Illinois, and get, you know, get the, you know, finish the job, whether it's a draw, whether it's a dominant win. Like they have to get this done and get into the next round, which is not the hexagonal. It's the Ocho now. So.
And obviously it sucks that this game can't actually be in Canada, as we make the Bridgeview jokes at BMO, out in Vancouver. It would be popping. This is the game they've been waiting for, which is actually one of the reasons I think this is so important. You want to qualify for the World Cup, but to get into the next round, to get a bunch of big home games against Mexico, U.S., Honduras, to have that moment for this men's national team to kind of get out of the shadow of the women's national team a little bit and to establish themselves in the country going into 2026 as not just we're here because we're hosts. That's what the U.S. obviously did in 1990, getting to Italy. Even if Canada doesn't get to the World Cup, I think getting past this stage and being competitive in the next round does a lot of that internally in terms of coverage and respect. And so I think this is a huge moment. One of the things that's been interesting is Alphonso Davies. You know, the question was, well, he's a left back, but he's the best player on Canada. How do you use him? And it seems like that the coaching staff, John Herdman, has found a way to let him have freedom, but also still play him in a comfortable position.
I mean, it's the obvious way. He went to a 3-5-2. Yeah. You know, they have three elite for the region center forwards and Jonathan David, Kyle Larin, and Lucas Cavallini. They don't have a ton of elite wingers. They have Alphonso Davies, who is at his best as an overlapping fullback, but you could really only be an attacking overlapping fullback to that degree if you're on a team that's going to dominate the ball. Well, Canada's not going to dominate the ball against most good teams in this region. So the obvious way to make him a hybrid player is to add another center back and to go with a 3-5-2. That also frees up Richie Larea on the other side. And it guarantees that you're going to have three central midfielders who can, if not create out of central midfield, because they've struggled with that a bit, at the very least be hard to play against. And I think that's a big step forward. I wouldn't be comfortable with any of this as a Canada fan, were it not for the emergence of Scott Kennedy, the big left-footed center back who I had never seen play before the game against
Suriname. You're not watching the German fourth division?
I'm not watching the German. I thought he was in the two.
Maybe.
Second Bundesliga.
I may have been overly offensive there.
Yeah, I think you were overly offensive there. Now, I do have questions about how he's going to hold up in the open field at times, but he has been a borderline revelation over the past 180 minutes. Kind of like a throwback type of center back who wins everything in the air, is tough in the tackle. You know, he's got a good left foot, but he's not doing anything Like, he's not John Brooks with his distribution, but he doesn't have to be. He just has to be sort of that centerpiece or focal point. And it's made a huge difference because I think going into this round of qualifiers, we all looked at that roster and we said, they have a ton of attacking talent. You know, they have some good central midfield talent, but it's worthwhile to be concerned about center back. And to this point, their center backs have done the job, and Kennedy's the biggest part of that.
So, Caleb, they had a big game last week against Suriname. Then you play Haiti in Haiti on Saturday. You turn around, and now you have to play on Tuesday. Do you think these a lot of these guys can go again, or would you see heavy changes for this Canada squad?
I think you'll go again. I think a lot of the players will stick through and just look. And I going back to the point on Davies and where he plays, I mean, these are some questions that we're asking about the U.S. team as well, not to bring it back to the U.S. system, with Des. But I think giving some protection. The other thing with Davies is he's so dynamic that I almost wonder if you don't necessarily need possession to be able to get in behind, because he's just such a one-way threat that even playing more direct through your outside back or wing back or whatever is possible with him. We saw in that first match where it's just able to kind of, you know, it was a good ball, but you can just almost put anything back there and he's going to make you turn around and go back. And then you see it defensively as well too. But I always think it's best if you want to put a guy in this best position. And then for Canada, I agree with what you guys have said. Like, I remember talking to Osorio, this was maybe a year or so ago, maybe longer. And he was talking about just the importance for Canada to qualify and to go through this process, not just as, you know, with 2026 in mind, but even for some of those guys who might be, I think Osorio's maybe, how old is he?
26, 27.
Yeah. So you'd expect him to be involved kind of regardless, but still, like, this is a good age for a lot of players in this group, whether, and still some young players as well too. So I think it's important for them to kind of get past the next steps, which I think leads back to the original question of trying to run it back with a lot of similar names.
Yeah, and you'd hope with a fairly young group that they're able to bounce back. There was an incredible, I think, 15 minutes though at the end where Sam Adekube came on the field, and Alphonso Davies, I'm pretty sure, was playing a number 10 position. Like, that's what he did. Pretty early on, he turned and just went straight up the middle of the field with the ball, and it was like one of those moments where you're like, this is like a guy who's like playing with U13s and is clearly the best player on the field. There are moments.
He's a best player in CONCACAF, man. Like Christian Pulisic is great. You know, Raul Jimenez is awesome. There are a lot of good players in this confederation. Alphonso Davies is the best. He is just spectacular out there, whatever position you put him in.
Yeah, it's been fun to watch him do his thing. Shout out to Alistair Johnston, who's got two really big performances at right center back, protecting Richie Larea. And then the goal in this one, Eustáquio plays it through the right side, and Richie blocks his defender but doesn't touch it to let it run through. Osorio hits a first-time ball in. And Kyle Larin, we have not talked about him a ton on this show, but he had a huge season at Besiktas. He's worked his way back into the national team. He filled minutes at the last window when Jonathan David wasn't available. And now he's won the spot over Cavallini, and he's been a massive part of this young group. And Doyle, you mentioned all these attackers.
Yeah, I mean, it has taken him a while, but he's become, like, when he came into MLS, he was just a goal scorer. That was the only thing he did. And he's such a well-rounded center forward now. He even played on the wing a little bit for Besiktas, though I kind of hate him there. But his ability, whether it's, you know, he's in the front three or whether he's playing in a two, as he has been with Jonathan David these past couple of days, he finds space. He makes the right plays. He's a very good hold-up option and physical presence, obviously. And then when he's been in position to, you know, score a telling goal, he's been putting the ball in the back of the net. And, you know, he's the starter for Besiktas. Besiktas is a Champions League team. That's the ceiling that we all saw for Kyle Larin a few years ago. And it's nice to see him hitting it for club and for country.
Hey, it's been big for him. Obviously, Jonathan David, no goal in this game. Hat trick against Suriname to help them seal a spot in this round. So he's had the performances that you've been looking for as well. Awesome for Canada. Huge moments, obviously. A ton of stress going into this last game. I wouldn't be shocked if you saw Samuel Piette come into this team as like a safety player in the game like this where they basically just need to tie. no matter what the scoreline is, a tie gets Canada through. And you saw that last game against Suriname as well. And you saw Samuel Piatt getting to the side. So I wouldn't be surprised to see the Montreal captain step in there as well. And maybe a few other changes. But as Kalen said, you'd expect to see the same team. And then you've got Gold Cup to kind of build yourself up for John Herdman's style, because he hasn't had that much time with this team because of COVID. And then you go into World Cup qualifying in the fall, and with the pieces this team has, they can kind of hurt anyone in this region. They're not going to be favorites, I don't think, to qualify, but a really good opportunity.
So I don't know about that. Because if you look
think on, they go in as a top, because you have to be top four, right?
If you look on just pure talent, right? I think that Mexico and the U.S. are a tier above everyone else. Isn't Canada third? If you looked at Canada's roster versus that roster we saw for Honduras that the U.S. played against, certainly the Costa Rican side, Costa Rica's in a similar position in terms of their generational shift that the U.S. were in last cycle, mm-hmm. where most of their great players have aged out and the generation below them has not produced talent at the same level. And then so a lot of it is falling on these young players who have not looked that great so far. So those are the big four. Question is, has Jamaica added enough talent?
Mikel Antonio.
Right?
Came out this week. That's a pretty good center forward.
Right. So has Jamaica added enough talent? And who else would it be? It would be like Curacao?
Yeah. I think how hard Honduras is going to be to play at home is guaranteed points that Canada doesn't have. But you're right. On paper, your argument stands. Mm-hmm. The back line and center backs are questionable mm-hmm. at that level for Canada. And yeah, I don't think anyone has more high level talent than they do in this conversation outside of Jamaica. Because if you're talking Leon Bailey, you're talking about Andre Gray, all these other guys that are coming over from England, plus now Mikel Antonio and Mariapa and whatever. There's a lot of talent there. I don't think Curaçao is at the level of Canada right now, high end. But yeah, so you're right.
Curaçao's in good position to get through. They got a 2-1 loss at Panama, and I thought they were actually probably a little better than Panama in that game. I don't know if you watched it.
It was a miracle that anyone played soccer on that field game. It rained the day before, and yet every time someone moved, there's just water splashing up like it was currently raining.
To get back to the point that Kalen was making, and you were making too, about the importance of getting to this round, is the difference between Canada as a national team and Honduras and Costa Rica and Panama is just culturally, like, first of all, soccer is more important in those Central American countries than it is in Canada right now. That's one. And two, they have that firsthand experience. They have that on-the-job know-how of going into CONCACAF games and doing what it takes to get wins or to get draws and to know how to make a home field advantage a real home field advantage. And Canada doesn't have that. So while, I just said on paper, they're probably the third most talented team in the confederation, in the federation. It's different on grass, and it's huge for this generation, which is largely very young, to get in there and to go through these wars to get into the World Cup. And if they're not favorites, it's because they don't have that. We've never seen them do that.
Yeah, I would take Honduras. If someone was like, you have to take a choice between the two, I would take Honduras right now for that reason. Right. And that's why it's so important for Canada to get through and get into those matches to test themselves, because we saw what happened when, the U.S. team were like, where are they on this sort of spectrum? Are they a team that's talented on paper with players playing at big clubs all over the world, just very similarly, or are they a team that knows how to go again a tough match against Honduras or against Mexico? And that's sort of a step that is still TBD, I think, for this Canada side.
And I would argue it's TBD a little bit for this U.S. generation as well. Because, I wrote about this in my column today. Like, in past generations, Marcelo Balboa and John Harkes and Tab Ramos passed that knowledge down to Brian McBride and Claudio Reyna and Eddie Pope. And those guys passed it down to Donovan and Beasley and Dempsey, and they passed it down to Michael Bradley and Jozy Altidore, and then there was no focal point after them to pass that down. Skipped a generation, and it had to go to Christian Pulisic, who, you know, was great but wasn't really ready to be and shouldn't have been asked to be a leader in that last cycle. So this U.S. team with Pulisic and McKennie and Adams is sort of the Gio Reyna is sort of the leadership. They have to get that experience as well. The difference is they have the padding of having guys like John Brooks, who has been there, and DeAndre Yedlin, Tim Ream, Paul Areola, guys who have sort of been through all of that in the past to sort of fill out the rest of the roster.
It's going to be interesting coming down to it. I will say one last thing, and not to question the Canadians, but if you were to come into a three-window World Cup qualifying cycle and you had an away game at Honduras in Canada, I think you'd roll out your starters at Canada and think it's more of gettable points, where Honduras, it's like, let's try and just get our guys through this and not have it affect us the rest of the way.
You know what mail we're going to get because of that?
The Canadians?
Remember the last time the U.S. played at Canada in an official competition?
Dude, that was pre-Daryl DK. That's a whole different world. It's AD and BC. Before the common DK era and after DK. Anno DK. So exciting stuff for Canada. I'm all in. We'll be on Twitter for this game as well, getting pumped up over the course of it on Tuesday night. And obviously good luck to the Canadians for MLS in general. We've got Euros going on. We've got Copa America somehow happening as well. Obviously, World Cup qualifying in Asia right now, and then the Gold Cup coming up. So it's a big summer. MLS is extremely involved in all of this. So Anders tracking this so far has 6,662 minutes and 10 goals for MLS players across all of these competitions so far in official comms. Shout out to Thomas as well, who... congratulations on your 3-0 win last Friday. Enjoy it while you can before Italy combusts later on in this tournament. So that's a lot to look forward to in Copa America. Seba Mendez, 30, full start, full 90 for Ecuador in their opening game, a loss to Colombia. We hope for the best right now for everyone involved in the Venezuela camp with a ton of COVID positive tests, not exact reports yet on who it is, but we hope everyone's okay there. Over in the Euros, a bunch of MLS players are involved. Robin Lode and Jukka Raitala both getting starts for Finland. Finland getting their first ever major tournament win in their also first ever appearance. So it's hard to win games if you've never played one before. And of course, that game, Christian Eriksen falling down, cardiac arrest, and then was revived and in the hospital. And so I think the only thing anyone cares about is that he's okay right now. And our thoughts go out to his friends and family, but it's a miracle that he was okay. And thank God for the first responders and the medics and everyone that was on site and able to take care of him. And so that was the best news of the weekend in the soccer world, without a doubt. And of course, they will all continue to play in Euros, which you can watch. And Frankowski will be involved, and Jan Gregus, and a bunch of Hungarians.
When you watch a tournament like this, do you pick a team that you're rooting for?
For the most part, I dislike teams more than I like teams. Okay. So I have enough teams to root against.
Would you be rooting against the most, David?
In Euros this time?
Yeah.
Man, it's a long list. That's a long list. You've got history. You've got cultures.
Space's power ranking.
Soccer teams that have wronged me. I'll just say this. It was a handball in Torrensen Frings, but I don't remember, and I'm not super worried about it anymore, and I've moved on.
I was falling in love with North Macedonia. I wanted to see them going. But, I'm trying to think who else I've been pulling for. I'm trying to think of even like, I don't know. Best goal so far? What do you think? You saw the one today.
Yeah, the one today was
Patrick Schick.
Yeah, from the midfield stripe is the best goal. But like, I'm 100% rooting for Belgium. Just, because this is a golden generation for them, and like, I have sympathy for that. But like, they go out there. There aren't a lot of international teams that go out there and try to play really good soccer, really attacking soccer. And more often than not, they have done that. They have entertained me. So I think, and just, I like it when a new team wins. I've never won it before. So I would like to see Belgium win the Euros Copa America, I know that, like, as MLS guys, we should be like, you know, vamos vino tinto, which would be
Paraguay.
Cool. Or Paraguay.
Or or the Netherlands for De Boer.
for Copa America, I'm rooting for Messi. I want to see Argentina win it. I think
Okay. That's very spiritual of you, or nostalgic of you. Can I throw this, and I don't want to take us into the wrong place. I know this is an MLS show, but Belgium got third place at a World Cup.
Yeah.
Like, is that not an accomplishment? Everyone's like, this is the last chance for the golden generation. I get winning trophies is great, but, like, that's an accomplishment.
For sure. Absolutely. I don't think this golden generation will be forgotten. Just like Portugal's from 20 years ago with Figo and Rui Costa. It's not forgotten either. But, like, it would be cool to see this Belgian generation hoist a trophy. Like, De Bruyne is maybe my favorite player in the world right now, after Messi. Lukaku's up there as well.
I hope he's third. I hope Lukaku's third on that list. I hope it goes Messi, De Bruyne, Lukaku.
Okay, again, for the sake of this month, that's the
also
order.
An unreal crest for the Belgians. I want to pull this question up from the mailbag since we're talking about it right now. Jared from Washington, D.C. says, I'd love to hear your takes on club football versus international football. What's more exciting? Were we blessed with Euros and Copa America and soon Gold Cup, but are league seasons more gripping or worth more? What is your guys' take on that?
I feel like I'm more, I can feel more of a fan, the times when I think of, like, the most incredible moments for me watching soccer growing up has been, like, with the U.S. men's national team, whether it was watching, like, young Landon and Bees in the World Cup, or that moment in Landon's Algeria goal. And then even I would add to this sort of last round where we're doing the post-game show, but you're watching it just as a fan. So I think international soccer for me has been more of that, where, like, when I watch the Dynamo or when I watch Chicago play, I'm like, yeah, I want them to win, but I don't feel quite the same, or it's hard for me to just fully separate and be like, no matter what, we've got to take this.
Right.
So it's a little bit different. So that gives a different opportunity.
You get to be more of an idiot in international tournaments.
Yeah, just irrational, crazy. Yeah, like, I can be, fully myself.
Which I appreciate, Doyle.
I think, like, the excitement of a World Cup or even a regional championship is tough to beat. That said, the delta between the quality of international soccer and club soccer, it's growing by the year. Club soccer at the top level is just, it's so much more intricate and so much more inventive than what we see in international soccer. And there's nothing wrong with that. I still, I'm watching every game of the Euros and watching every game of Copa America, but it's almost like a different sport at this point. I was joking with some friends watching the Scotland Czech Republic game, and we were joking that it was like getting into a time machine. The way Scotland played looked like 2005. You just don't see a lot of teams playing like that anymore, and it was like fun and refreshing to see that, which was cool. But like the best soccer in the world happens at the club level.
And I think you see it with the national teams where a lot of guys are from the same club, where there's that cohesive nature of, like, there's a way we play because national teams just aren't together that often. But
I mean, Spain 10 years ago,
for sure.
the obvious example of that, like having that core of 6-7 Barcelona players, and then you sprinkle in 5 Madrid guys, and they that was the best national team I've ever seen. It was because of talent, but also because they were able to take a lot of the principles that they refined at the club level and transport them to the international game, where in my mind they had sort of an outsized impact because, I mean, you have to be really well drilled to stop prime Xavi and Iniesta tiki-taka, and like you can't get that level of it's tough to achieve that when you're only playing 12 games a year, for are together a week at a time at most.
I will say the only thing I is as the two interact is, like, if you're watching the England games and you see more of like, you see some of Guardiola's style come in where you have a Phil Foden that doesn't really exist in the past. And I think even when I look at like the US men's national team, and there were moments where you have like these small little intricate combination passes where they build a triangle with whether it's, you know, Dest or Reyna or these guys, and you see them moving the ball like that. It's like, I haven't seen that a ton in the past with US teams. And so I think to look at somehow like how club football can sort of change the identity of a national team, England is probably the best example of seeing some of that right now. So
England is fun to watch, which is just, yeah. I hate it so much, but like they are like really fun. Even playing that 4-2-3-1 with an inverted left back, and like that team plays really good soccer. And that is, I think, an effect of the national team being downstream from the way that the club game has played. And I think we're seeing that here with the U.S. national team as well.
It's coming home for Doyle. We're going to see DeMannschaft pressing everyone in about 6 months now with their new manager as well. So looking forward to that.
Andrew Wiebe pinged me during the middle of that and wanted to make sure that we wished you a happy birthday.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Thanks, Andrew Wiebe. Hey. Appreciate that.
David turned 29.
Yeah. I got a great video from Cam Wiebe celebrating my birthday. So that was all I needed already. But
is that why he's not
that.
Feeling well? Was he just partied too hard?
Or? It was just too much for him. Yeah. He couldn't handle all the craft beers. let's move out of international soccer. Let's take it back home to MLS news. One game this weekend, SKC 1-1 at home against Austin FC, the final road game for Austin in this massive road span. Doyle, I know this was a lot of pressure from SKC, but I want to take 1 second for Austin. 1 point per game on the road was what they were looking for. Yeah. And they got it for this opening stretch. They're sitting where they want to be going home.
Yeah, 8 points from 8 games to open their MLS life. The only time they really looked outclassed during this trip was when they didn't have Alex Ring.
Yeah.
With him back and playing every game, they are a different team, a much, much better team. That said, I do wonder if he's rethinking his international retirement, because he would have been probably wearing the armband for that Finland team that got their first ever major tournament victory the other day. He is a massive difference maker for him, and he hit one of the passes of the year late in this game, left footed on the run, like 40-yard through ball. It was spectacular.
You're not cheating on Cade Cowell right now, are you?
Cade Cowell is still number one. Okay, right? Cool. That pass of his is still number one. Okay. But Ring's a special player, and Cecilio Dominguez is a special player, and they have a lot of good role players throughout. They still have massive questions at the back, and they have massive questions at center forward. But the most pleasant surprise, I think, for Austin has to be the play of Brad Stuver. He was the man of the match in this one, and he has been one of the best goalkeepers in MLS this year. And there hasn't been a ton of talk about it because he's not posting a lot of shutouts, but people should pay attention because he's been excellent.
He was unreal in this one.
He was
too.
Unreal.
And I think even when you look at the way they've matched up against SKC specifically in this matchup, like they took a lot of they were basically being peppered in this one, and were lucky to get away with a point, which is great. But it shows, I think they'll have learned a lot about themselves over the course of these 8 matches as well, too. They've done it in a couple different ways. They even played well against SKC in the first matchup until Ring went out with the red card. But 8 points from 8 matches is solid. And I feel like if you look at teams that have gone on the road through these like opening of stadiums or expansion and have backloaded home games at the end of the year or in the back half of the season, that's generally gone pretty well for clubs. And so to be able to not fall into a deep hole through those first away matches is tough. Plus you learn how to kind of like be solid defensively, how to suffer through a 1-1, you know, where you're just playing against Sporting and suddenly you're now going home and you're going to always feel a little bit more comfortable. They'll have the energy, excitement of the fans. So it'll be nice for those guys to put that piece of the season behind them, and suddenly it'll be a lot of home matches in a row that I think they can ride and maybe even climb up the standings.
Good
just
goal.
Just to contextualize, 8 points in 8 road games. Last year's MLS Cup winners, Columbus Crew, had 5 points in 10 road games. Last year's Supporters Shield winners, Philadelphia Union, had 13 points in 11 road games. So I'm not saying that Austin are going to win a trophy this year. I would be shocked if they did, but like that's like they're right around that level, and they have set themselves up to, as Kalen said, have a really good second half of the year here, or final two-thirds of the year here, because of how they opened their season with that long road trip.
And now they get to open a stadium, Q2 Stadium, 9 p.m. Eastern time, coming up this Saturday. That one's on Unimas Tudien. And, of course, you can watch it on Twitter in English against San Jose. It's going to be awesome. It's going to be a lot of fun to watch. We've all seen the shots of the stadium, the fans trying to start to get ready, playing some drums, all that type of stuff. It's going to be very green, or verde, if that's the word you prefer. Before we get into SKC, Austin Gets Soccer tweeted us and said, who's the best goalkeeper in the league this year, and why is it Brad Stuver? You guys just sang his praises. Is he in that running? Buzzkill, I didn't see that coming.
I mean, he's in the running. He's been really good. He's been, it's been really, really good.
Okay, so from one Harry Potter fan to another, I'll put you in the running, Brad Stuver. I got you. Don't worry about it. And then we've got another mailbag input from Twitter that says, is Shallowy a clear frontrunner for MLS Comeback Player of the Year award? And if he's not, what's wrong with you? Daniel Shallowy with a goal in this one. That's his fourth goal of the season, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. It is rare to see a guy who, seemed to really be breaking out a couple years ago, and scoring important goals down the stretch, being someone Sporting really relied on in a way, and then to sort of just completely flatline. And usually that when you see a player come back and you look at the list of maybe comeback players of the year, it's like Jossie Zardes, who gets a move from, playing right back at the Galaxy to, he's a number nine playing at Columbus and having, some sort of move. And it's very rare to see a guy, I think, within the same system, same club, same everything, have success, fall off, and then have success. So credit to him, and credit to Vermees for, I guess, giving him another shot and giving him another run of games. Because even the way he took his chance in this one, it wasn't overly complicated, but he just looked confident. And could have had a couple more this season actually as well. So the only other name I might put up there, well, there's actually probably a number of names. Chicharito, right?
This is like a Ben Bear take, right?
Yeah, this is the Ben Bear take.
Yeah, you go ahead, David. You explain it.
Ben Bear's point was, can you be the comeback player if all you're coming back from is being trash? Obviously, that was an extreme wording of that take. But mm-hmm. The point is, the that comeback player can exist for – it sounds like Ben, right? Exist for a player who returned from mainly injury, right? Or for another reason, not being able to play soccer, versus someone coming back from poor seasons, which – in the definition of the award is allowed. The question is, which way do you lean on it?
I mean, the name I was brought up, actually, Chicharito, is actually a really good example of that, because now I think he's a perfect example in a way because of he's been so vocal about his sort of mental health issues. Mm-hmm. And so I think as we look to maybe redefine that it's not just an injury that can hold you back from success, then maybe that begins to chip away at some of that, those hot takes to say that you can only come back from a devastating knee injury to return to playing at a high level. And you never know what's going on with these guys. The other guy I would put up there would be Jesus Medina. I think it's 5 goals right now for NYCFC, which you would not have expected.
How is he a comeback player, though? Because he was never there. Right?
Okay. Isn't it more of like a so breakout? He'd be more of like a breakout player.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I would think, what about like Jack Elliott? Jack Elliott was a starter for a couple years with a really good Union team and then lost his job last year and then slotted right back into the lineup this year, replacing a best 11 center back. And he has been, for my money, one of the three best center backs in the league this year.
Yeah. And that's tough, though, with when you're, it's not so much your form dips. It's just that I think he was more
McKenzie
of a
glass. Yeah. So. But a point stands. I get it.
Yeah. I like the idea of Frankie Amaya awards. Frankie Amaya
came back from playing at FC Cincinnati and now playing for the New York Red Bulls. Totally kidding, Cincy fans. way too many people took heat on that entire conversation. So I apologize to everyone involved.
Everyone.
Yeah. Just for Ben's sake, like Kevin Garnett says, you can't hold us back. No one can hold us back. Let's move into a little bit of news in MLS. FC Dallas signing Facundo Quignon, a 28-year-old central defensive midfielder from Lanús, like 20 minutes ago, just out of nowhere. They announced it by releasing a video of him saying hola with no name or connection to who he was. And now we know who he is. Does anyone have an initial take on this?
Dallas's defense has been poor this year. If you look at the underlying numbers and just like watch the games, they've been creating a lot of chances, right? They haven't finished them. And that goes to a longstanding problem with Dallas for the last 5 years. Their top end players have not produced like top end players, but like they have gotten better pushing forward. The bigger difference between this year's Dallas and last year's Dallas is that they are suddenly very vulnerable defensively. And that is another, like, the underlying numbers confirm what you're seeing with your own eyes. I'm not convinced that the problem was necessarily at defensive midfield. I thought that Brian Acosta has actually been pretty good this year. But I understand why they would want to make a move there. But I do think that getting Matt Hedges healthy and back in the lineup is the best move that Dallas could make for this team right now, because they are just a different and much worse team when he's not out there.
So Dallas making moves early here in the summer. Steve Goff reporting as well that Bayern Munich officials are heading to Texas to discuss a permanent transfer for Justin Che to Bayern from FC Dallas. And he puts in here FC Dallas probably seeking more than the $1.5 million that they got for Chris Richards when he went from Dallas to Bayern as well. So something to keep an eye out on. And obviously that talent keeps churning through.
He was just called in, right? Didn't he get he was with the team in camp, right? With the national team?
He went to the Switzerland game.
Okay.
Because he was over in Europe and they were short a few players. One other piece of news, Rodolfo Pizarro rumors have been out. We've done more national team stuff, so we didn't get this in. It was more last week than this week. Obviously, things haven't gone perfectly in Miami with him. The rumors that were reported initially was a connection to Chivas and Monterrey, which, you know, coincidence. Those are two teams he used to play for, and I'm sure fans have tweeted out that he could go there. It makes sense, I think, from both parties if there was a move to come, right? Miami's now sort of signed a reset under a different sporting group, a different coach. Maybe he doesn't fit the plans of that group as much. And for him, he was a starter under Tata Martino and then didn't start in either of the Nations League games. So he's still looking to work his way back into that. Is there any other teams that come to mind that make sense for you too?
You're smiling. Go ahead and say it.
No, you say it. You were the one who came up with it. And it was great.
One of the things we don't see a lot in MLS with DPs is if a DP isn't working out in, you know, for one team in one particular market, they don't often get traded to another team. Pizarro was not the right fit for Miami for what they need him to do and asked him to do. He has been the right fit in the past playing for Matias Almeida. And San Jose need someone who could be a bit of an alpha coming in off that left wing. They have plenty of open DP slots, and we know how Almeida feels about his former players. So I would like to see some sort of trade worked out that gets Pizarro to the Quakes, because I think he fits a need for them. I think he would play better in that system than he has played for Phil Neville so far in Miami. It makes sense from a marketing fit in San Jose, to be perfectly honest. And we know that Tata, like, he's totally fine with his players being in MLS. If Pizarro gets a move to another MLS team and starts playing up to his capabilities, he will go right back into the discussion for Mexico being a starter. So I just, like, it seems like Rodolfo Pizarro is going to move. I understand why there would be interest from a lot of Liga MX teams. There should be interest from the Quakes as well.
Okay.
There just absolutely should be.
I like that. If we're going to keep playing this game, though, if we're going to go down this rabbit hole, could he also not make sense for Chicago Fire? Chicago looking for a chance creator.
He's not really a chance creator, though. That's the problem. That's the problem that everybody makes with Cesaro. That's why we said they're kind of crazy to make this guy their number 10 signing.
Yeah, not a number 10, but I feel like I like the way he's able to be a little bit more direct. And I think Chicago at times has looked, they either bypass the midfield or they don't seem to have, or it seems to be kind of plotting as far as how they try to build and just get going, getting forward. So I don't know. I think it'd be interesting for a lot of the same reasons.
If you put him on the left wing, right, because he wants to come inside and combine around a box a bit, and he's clever about that, and playing off of Berić and with Madron and Jimenez in that central midfield. And then you have Frankowski on the right wing, who's much more of a direct player, can open up the field up. I agree that Chicago would be very interesting.
It is hard to move a DP, though.
I was going to say, I don't want to rain on your fantasy. I don't know that Chicago has an open DP spot, which would because they have Aliceta, Jimenez, and Barrett. So one would have to go in the other direction to Miami, or you have to now add a third team in, and now we're breaking every record, which I love. I am here for the let's move a DP one spot over for every team. Yeah. Let's see how it works.
My dream is Hector Herrera for Chicago.
Yeah. Ooh, Ace, Ace. Living it up in Chi-Town, baby. Listen, those games would sell out immediately if that move was made. And that would be pretty cool to see. Let's jump into a little more MLS before we finish up. Adam Taylor on Twitter says, what teams are most over or underperforming the underlying advanced metrics so far? Who's a good bet to move across the playoff line one way or the other? This was a question for you guys. That's how the mailbag works. I'm just watching Poland, Slovakia.
We're at the point now where the underlying numbers for expected goals, like season long expected goals, and there are other more advanced statistics, like the guys at American Soccer Analysis do G+ goals added. They start to really be reliably predictive. And what we're seeing from those is that NYCFC are legit one of the best teams in the league. And their record is pretty good. But given how well they've played, it would be surprising if they didn't end up being very, very good, especially when you combine it with the amount of talent they have coming into the roster via transfers, or just guys like Tinnerholm getting healthy and coming back and being fit, and hopefully Eber at some point too. So they're a team that I would look to climb the table a little bit. Montreal have done a good job. They're right around NYCFC in the table, but if you look at their numbers, like it's a little bit iffy as to whether or not they're going to be able to stay there, which is not to say they can't overperform their expected goals. But it's tough to do that over the course of a season. Nashville is the interesting one, because if you look at Nashville just based on the underlying numbers, they're one of the best teams in the league.
Because
they've been playing from behind so often. They've been playing at home so often. And then there are a bunch of outlier games against the likes of Cincinnati or honestly the Montreal game, where they took 30 shots because they were at home and because they were they were playing from behind. So it's a little tough still to go across the board and say they're moving up, they're moving down, they're moving up. But if you want me to bet on one moving up, it's NYCFC. And if you want me, let me just check real quick. If you want me to bet on one moving down, I don't want to dunk too hard on our friends in Montreal.
Well, the other thing about Montreal is there's something outstanding, which is, are they going to have legit home games towards the end of this year? And that changes the ability they can to play their entire lives. So that's a whole outlier that you can't calculate for. Anders, by the way, because Nashville, you mentioned Nashville, rumor is Ake Loba from Monterrey may be headed that way. So Anders, you now have your YouTube titles of either Rodolfo Pizarro traded to San Jose or Ake Loba headed to Nashville. So Anders, you are welcome for that.
I have looked at zero underlying numbers, but I'm happy to chime in here with just to say I think New York Red Bull might be a team that would be a good bet to move up over the line as far as Stuber coming in, and then a young team that I think will get better as they figure out that system. DC, just based on the number of injuries they've had, I think in the second half of the year, you think these guys starting to get healthy, come back into form. And then in the Western Conference, I like Austin just because they've had that first, we talked about those first eight games on the road coming home, and LAFC just because there's too much quality for this team to continue to be in the form that they're in. So as far as dropping down, I hate to do that. I'm just going to stay positive and say that this is it. I would say San Jose, we've seen them crash late in seasons. Can they play that style throughout the year? Is that sustainable? And I would
say, it will be when they have Rodolfo Pizarro on the field.
There you go. And then, Montreal is kind of it's kind of one of those where it's like they've got off to a really good start. Is that sustainable? I kind of think it might be, but they could be vulnerable. And those would be the ones I would say are a little bit more fragile than Kalen. Most. And Nashville, they can't score goals, so that makes me nervous too.
I stand against your archaic take that DC United having players available makes them better going forward. Is so pre-analytics and data of you.
I'm just not sure that with MLS teams playing three games a week for basically the entire second half of the season, how healthy any of these teams is going to be able to. I mean, we've seen it with the NBA season, right? Like a number of soft tissue injuries.
But DC, so, they just got them all out the way early.
DC, they're ready to rock.
It is going to make it interesting, right? Because part of managing the regular season has always been squad rotation, and certain MLS managers are not great at it. And those guys are like, those teams are going to suffer. They are absolutely going to suffer. And this is where we can clip in a soundbite of Adrian Heath saying that Americans are overly obsessed with substitutions. So there
Adrian Heath, comeback coach of the year, came back in the same season. It's on the record. I wanted to follow up though with an NYCFC question, because you mentioned NYCFC first when you talked about the data. My name Leroy on Twitter asked, they've added Talas Mongo, they've added Thiago Andrade, they've added Santi Rodriguez. What's your opinion of what this team's ceiling is now? And you talk about depth, you talk about rotation. It's hard to get young guys in year one, but NYCFC, I think the biggest question mark to come into the season was, where are the pieces? And now they've added about five or six going forward.
Yeah, they've added a bunch of what are on paper great pieces. That doesn't always work out, right? Like, these guys are in the same price range as like Barco and Matias Pellegrini and, you know, Julian Carranza. And like those guys did not push those respective teams up. So you have to wait and see how good they are in this league. I mean, even on
there's the alarm. It's time
on NYCFC, Cachas Acevedo came in with a ton of hype last year, and he basically didn't play, and he's only started to get regular minutes now. So it might not be the instant boost into the ranks of like the apex contenders, but then again, it might. So we won't know until we see it on the field. The real thing, though, is if you look at MLS Cup winners of the past 5 years, they all have players like Raul Ruiz Diaz or Joseph Martinez or Jose Altidore, or, you know, Sebastian Giovinco leading the line. And so, like, you kind of need that type of center forward, I think, to win MLS Cup in MLS, you know, these days. And can Tati Castellanos hit that level? I have my doubts. He's very good, but I have my doubts he can be that guy. But can this team be a supporter shield contender? Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Because it's a different competition. It's about depth and squad management and week-to-week intensity and consistency. And I do think that what I've seen from this NYCFC team bodes well for that.
It sounded like you were specific about that wording. You think they have a shot at MLS Cup in CPL, but not in MLS. That's the difference. That breakdown. I want to throw in, I think Kalen mentioned Red Bulls. Fabio's loan has been extended to the end of the season. He's obviously been a huge factor for them so far. So some of the news that's broken, you know, during this international window. I'm going to throw this email in, not for response, I'm just reading it. Apparently, Charlie put out a call to Sounders fans. I don't remember that, but one fan group that will answer any call to action are Seattle Sounders fans. So Lindsay emailed us and said, as a Sounders fan, want to respond to Charlie's new hoop question. Short answer is yes. He has grown significantly during the past couple years, and he's been lights out good so far this year. Arguably the best defender in the league right now. I will add to this, though, that this three-back system takes best advantage of his strengths. He's always been a great one-on-one lockdown defender. Now that he's not expected to be bombing forward in Smetcher's system that gets its width from the outside backs, he can do what he does best and completely nullify all opposing offenses coming into his area. I think he would struggle a bit more as one of two central defenders, but having those two other guys next to him gets the best out of him, and he's able to help out. So, Charlie, there's your answer. I don't even know what the question was, but we nailed it for you. I want to close out last MLS mailbag question, and we're going to connect two of these. The first one is, are Philadelphia Union in a better spot to repeat Supporter Shield than we thought they would be up to this point? And the second is from Florida Coco, who says, who's your way too early coach of the year so far? I think there's a clear connection. Therefore, I asked it that way. You guys are welcome to disagree. But my point is, Jim Curtin has to be in that conversation, especially when you add in the CCL run, which it's not MLS games, but it can't be outside of people's minds who are voting. He has done better with this group than I thought he would. The level has dropped less than I expected. And it hasn't just been, we'll plug in Anthony Fontana and move on. He has moved pieces around. He's brought in Leon Flock. You talked about Jack Elliott getting back into the team. And Baizo stepping in as Ray Gattis retired late before the season. Another big move. He's been able to maintain with some players, make some tweaks, and continue to be successful. So Jim Curtin would be my vote.
I think Greg Vanney has a good shout. If the Galaxy can continue, and especially if they end up near the top three, as I think they're third right now in the West, if they're able to kind of hold position, hold form, or maybe even improve that, just based on where that club has been and where they look to be going, I feel like that could be a really a good shout for coach of the year. And then you always got to put in Bruce, just because they, you know, if New England goes on and wins the Supporters Shield, or I think he's done a really good job as far as managing his sort of pool of strikers and picking one and then the next. And then, of course, when you've got Carlos Hill, is probably the shout for MVP right now. That tends to help.
I appreciate Kalen knows that Bruce might be looking for a backup center forward later this season. He knows he listens to the show. He throws it in there.
Kalen is a veteran with playoff experience. Like, that is right up Bruce's alley right there.
Yeah, I've been on the wrong side of Bruce's teams mostly. Yeah.
Brian Schmetzer is the other obvious one for coach of the year. I think if there was a coach of the year vote right now, mine would go to Schmetzer for sure. Yeah. But to tie the two together, you're like, Curtin is a top tier candidate for Bruce of the Year, for Coach of the Year, for Coach of the Year right now. And it's because Philly are so much better than we all thought they were going to be after losing two best 11 caliber players. And, you know, they did bring in some reinforcements, but in typical Philly fashion, these were not, you know, high profile, like, oh, plug and play, this guy is going to be an all-star caliber. They brought in a lot of young guys, and Curtin has immediately coached them up. They've almost immediately integrated. I think he's actually done a better job of rotating the squad this year than he did last year, which bodes well for their ability to compete in MLS and CCL throughout the semifinals and hopefully into the finals. It's been a fantastic year from Philly, or quarter of a year from Philly thus far. So he's in the discussion, but for now, it's Brian Schmetzer, coach of the year.
Until Daniel Gazdag blows up the Euros and gets out of a group with France, Germany, and Portugal, and then becomes the biggest signing in MLS history. Kayla, I want to follow up one quick one with you, which is, what do the Galaxy have to finish for Greg Vanney? Like, is playoffs enough with a good start and then just making the playoffs, or does it have to be a top tier in the Western Conference?
Go ahead, Caleb. Okay.
I think it's got to be. Go ahead, Doyle. I already kind of gave my take. I think they got to be top three.
If they make the playoffs, that's a step forward. If they make the playoffs while playing well and sort of rebuilding the culture that has been destroyed over the past half decade, that is more important to see that sort of culture of you know, a team ethos and, you know, responsibility 1 through 25 on the roster for how the entire team functions. And, you know, we've used the term optimism a lot in describing Chicharito and how that sort of funnels down to the rest of the roster. If we see that throughout the year and they finish sixth, I would take that over them finishing third, but just sort of lumping it up and looking like they did when Zlatan brought them to the playoffs that one time.
Yeah. So I don't think Vanny will care much either about this.
But does that get him in the coach of the year finalist?
No, maybe? And I don't expect him to. I put him in there as far as like it's sort of a different award almost. I think coach of the year usually is going to go to either the Supporters Shield winner or somebody at the very top. I'm not sure the Galaxy will get that high, but I think he's probably won coach of the year, or should have at least in the past, and I don't think he's going to be the. The point for the Galaxy is not just this year, right? They're looking to, and this year is important when you play for a club like Galaxy, like every year matters, right? And the expectations are to make a deep run into the playoffs. But it's more that there's a plan going forward and there's some sort of vision. They're developing young players. They're mixing in with stars. So they've got a good thing going there. But what he's done in the first half of the season has already, I had questions, I think, going into the year of like, what is this going to look like at all? Like, I have no idea almost. And now you see the way he's brought in even the vets and Vasquez and Sasha and these guys that have come in and really helped a lot of these young guys find their footing as well, too.
So there you go. Very exciting to see as we continue on in this MLS season. As I said, after the international break, returning this Friday, doubleheader, and then a full weekend of games highlighted by the debut of Q2 Stadium, another jewel in the MLS crown. It's going to be awesome to watch that thing open up and get going. Very excited for that one. I want to close you guys out on a national team question because we got a bunch. Obviously, we've had these few games, and we're going to talk Gold Cup more coming up. James Porter here on Twitter says, considering how dynamic Aronson and Tim Weah were and Greg Berhalter's previous comments about wingers who run in behind the D, should USMNT consider sliding Reyna or Pulisic inside as one of the eights to get one of those two on the field?
No. I mean, I think the hope is eventually that Gio Reyna will develop into that type of player. He's played there a little bit for Borussia Dortmund, but the way the U.S. play and the way CONCACAF is, you need the eights to be more of a two-way player. And I don't think it benefits the entire team to put Gio Reyna or especially Pulisic into that situation.
We got another one here. Sorry, I said I would be one. What about Pulisic as a false nine? Where Tuchel has played him.
Yeah, I hate that.
Get out of my face, Twitter trolls.
I understand why that's appealing in some ways. And let's say we had Tim Weah and Jordan Morris on the wings, then I could see Pulisic as a false nine working pretty well against certain opposition. But in general, in the world game, shots, the value of shots are getting better and better, and teams are getting smarter about how to generate shots right around the penalty area and in. And that's where true nines work. And I don't think that going out there without a true center forward is a great idea in this day and age. I just don't. We've seen it work occasionally, but there's most teams play with a true number nine. And I know that about to get flooded with Manchester City fans, but like,
yeah, but look at England.
Pep's teams are an outlier. Right. Pep's teams are an outlier for a reason.
Yeah, I see the sort of allure of it just with the idea that we haven't had number nine really emerge right now. But I think ultimately you still want to use Christian, on that left-hand side and allow him to kind of create from there. Plus, we have really good options in the middle of midfield. I think Leggett has stepped in as another one. I want to see Musa more. We got Weston. We're getting Tyler back. So I think we're in a pretty good spot there. It's really just about, I think we talked about this before covering the national team with like center backs, whether you go two or three, do you use three where you only are looking for two, or I generally feel like if you have a broken part of the car, you fix that one part. You don't try and move other pieces around in different places to just sort of get whatever you can out of it. I still think a 9 will emerge. It's just that spot is still there for the taking.
And it's kind of crazy the way we talk about that number 9 position, because like Josh Sargent hasn't been super productive, obviously, but like Borussia Mönchengladbach, which is a team that is, you know, they're a top 7 team in the Bundesliga. They're about to spend millions on him to play as a number 9 for them. You know, Daryl Dike was awesome in MLS and was even better in the championship. And like, there's a good chance he will move for $10 or $15 million this summer. You know, we saw what Jordy Pefok did in his appearances for the U.S., scoring, like by the second half of the year, he was scoring goals all the time in Switzerland. We know what Jossie Zardes
and Europa League.
And Europa League, thank you. And we know what Jossie Zardes has been over the past couple of years for the U.S., like ultra reliable. I'm just not concerned about the number 9. I think we have good options there already. And I would be surprised if a year from now we don't consider at least one of them to be a great option. So I don't think it makes sense, and especially to get back to, and I know we're going long on the segment, but you're going to have to indulge me. One of the things with Pulisic as the number 8, everybody thinks about those plays where he was able to get on the ball in central midfield against Mexico, turn, and then drive the game forward. I think he skinned Acheache one time, and there are a couple others, but I think he dragged Edson Alvarez up.
Nestor Araujo still has nightmares.
Yeah, like, Nestor Araujo. So those, but like those plays don't happen because he's already stationed in central midfield. Those plays happen because of the U.S. team shape in the buildup has sort of tilted the field and opened up this big gap so that when Pulisic checks to the ball, there's only actually one defender with him. And that is the situation we want. That's a situation where he can turn and can, off the dribble, sort of unlock a defense. And if he's in that number 8 role, he's the one who's going to be dropping back and, you know, having to make defensive plays to help out a fullback to sort of tilt the field in the first place. So I don't think it's a good use of resources. The other thing that I wanted to add, you know, the way the question was framed is Weah and Aronson as wingers who run in behind the defense. That is not what Aronson does at this point. Aronson does not get behind the defense. What he's really good at are those situations like with Pulisic, dropping back and then immediately playing forward, whether it's off the dribble or finding a progressive pass to move the game forward. He's incredibly dynamic in those situations, but he doesn't get behind the back line a lot. That's actually something he's got to work on in his game. With Weah, I think Weah is just brilliant. So put him out on the left side or the right side, or put him as sort of a false number 9. I would be happy with any of that. I want to see more of Timmy Weah in the national team with the first team.
Oh, good thing you saved that, Doyle, because when you dismissed it early and I'm Weah and Aronson Hive, I was about to cut this entire show off and just walk off the set. I do, at center forward, I still know that in case of emergency, you break the glass and just roll Connor Casey out there again. He'll give you 35 minutes down in Honduras that you can play off of him. On that note, let's close with Jake from DC, who says, first of all, I really enjoyed Weeby's reference to lighting a bunch of black cats. Last show, Goss needs to come down from his ivory tower in Brooklyn and meet some real Americans. Maybe at a soccer match between the Heston Swathers and the Newton Railers. Well, on that note, I'm going to go eat my vegan toast and I'm going to go hang out in Brooklyn and do whatever it is I want and grow my ponytail out and get some cool glasses. But thank you guys for joining us, Matt Doyle and Kalen Carr. And of course, all of you out there watching, we'll be back on Thursday with Charlie Davies and presumably Andrew Wiebe, but everyone knows that Cam and Wyatt call the shots in that household.
Day to day. Cam and Wyatt are day to day right now.
If not, we'll figure something else out. Thank you to Anders for helping us produce this show as well. And to all of you, have a great week.